Case this morning, case number 6844, Lieski versus Stepan. How am I doing on these names?
Lieski versus Stepan.
Well, it's close. Thank you. And we're ready for Mr. Albright. And did you want to reserve some time, Mr. Albright?
3 minutes.
I'll try to keep an eye on the clock.
Thank you, Justice Trey. May it please the court, Chris Albright, appearing on behalf of the appellants, Dr. John Lieski and his wife, Sonia, who are here with me in court this morning. We are here seeking to overturn a judgment upholding a over $4.5 million mechanics lien against my client's property in downtown Reno. I would like to address, first of all, the lien claimant's failure to abide by the statutory mandate of NRS 108.245 by providing a written notice as required by that statute. Whereas mechanics liens are an extraordinary legislative gift to a certain class of creditors. And as with any gift, the gift giver can impose whatever conditions on that gift that the legislature wishes to impose. And in keeping with the due process implications of a mechanics lien, one of the conditions that has been imposed by our legislature is that you must send a written notice, not only that work has begun, but that mechanics lien rights are therefore being claimed with respect to the property. And I think it's important, that second component, in case the landowner is somebody who happens to have gone to medical school instead of law school. Now, this court has crafted a very narrow exception to the mandate of NRS 108.245. And there's really three tests that a mechanics lien claimant needs to meet in order to qualify for that exception. First, they have to be performing work upon the property. Second, they have to demonstrate that the property owner knew not only that work was being performed upon the property, but knew the identity of the lien claimant. And finally, they need to demonstrate, in order to satisfy subsection 6 of the statute, when the actual notice of their identity took place and how much of the work had been done before or after that push. Because one of the things the legislature did to make this easy on lien claimants is they said, look, you don't have to send this out within the first 31 days after you start work. That used to be the case, but they said, we're going to let you, if you forget 30 months, you can send this notice halfway through the project, and we'll let you lien for anything you do from 31 days before that point forward. Now, with respect to the first test, the lien claimant indicates that that's not really a test. It just happens to be the case that all of the other cases dealing with this issue were work upon the property kind of cases. But that's just not so, Your Honors. The fact of the matter is that if you look at the Fondren decision, what Fondren explained is that the court was not so much creating an exception to the written mandate statute. What the court was doing in Fondren and in the Durable Developers case that preceded it is it was simply applying another section of the statute. NRS 108.234 already said that when work is performed upon the property, that's a red flag danger day for the property owner. And if he receives notice of that work being performed upon the property and doesn't take certain steps to protect his property from being subject to a lien, then he's in a position where he can be treated like the guy who's not entitled to written notice anyway. And so if your honors were to do what the lien claimant needs you to do in this case, and you're to expand this exception so now it applies even to somebody who's not performing work upon the property, so the property owner could be walking by that property every day for months without having an inkling that, oh my goodness, today's the day. Today's the red flag day. Something has happened. I need to protect myself. What you're really doing is not just expanding the exception. What you're really doing is you're rewriting NRS 108.234. And as you indicated recently in the cash and equipment case, it's not the prerogative of this court to rewrite the lien statute. That's solely a creation of statute, and it's up to the lien claimant, it's up to the legislature to amend that. The other two tests that were not met here I think I've argued in the brief, and in the interest of time, I won't say a lot about them this morning. But I will address this idea that notice to an attorney might have qualified somehow. It's notice to the Ilyeskis. If you look at the Fondren case, there was an attorney that knew that work was being performed upon the property, and that attorney told the client, told the property owner that work was being performed upon her property, gave regular updates. And as Hardy Companies pointed out, in that case, it made sense for the attorney's knowledge to be imputed to the client. If you look at the Noah case, which they cite in their respondent's brief, in Noah, there was a written notice required under a lease. And that written notice was sent to the lessor, I believe it was, not to the lessor, but to the lessor's attorney. And in that case, this court said, notice to that attorney sufficed to satisfy the lease. And so maybe in this case, if you had the written notice required by NRS 101.245 having been sent to somebody at the law firm that represented the OEMQ, then maybe Noah would apply. But the idea that any time an attorney knows anything, that's imputed against his client, is just not true. I can know a lot of things that aren't imputed against my client. I can know that my client has been sued. But that doesn't mean that my client is not entitled to a service of a summons and a complaint, or that he can be defaulted, and then the defaulting party can say, or the plaintiff can say, well, his attorney knew he filed suit, so he wasn't entitled to service. The reason for the written mandate is because, make no mistake about it, mechanics liens affect real property interests. And therefore, they raise due process concerns.
Should we be concerned with the owner's affidavit?
I'm sorry?
Should we be concerned with the owner's affidavit of authority?
The owner's affidavit that was attached to certain of the applications that were sent to the city of Reno, the timing of that is such that by the time that owner's affidavit is signed, the work appears to have already been completed more than 31 days beforehand. Remember, what happens in this case is that there's a guy named David Snellgrove who is helping to put together, the architect has done all this work, and then they hire Snellgrove's company, Wood Rogers, to come in and present all this to the city council. And as part of what they want to present to the city council, they ask the Ilyeskis to come over and sign off on an owner's affidavit. And Snellgrove testifies in his affidavit that when the Ilyeskis were there to sign that, they would have seen some plans that had Stephen's name on them. But then when he's deposed, and he's asked more specifically, well, do you know if the Ilyeskis were shown those plans that had Mr. Stephen's name on them? He says, no. And he's asked, did you talk about Mr. Stephen's name with the Ilyeskis? Well, I can't recall. And so I think that, but even if you were to say, no, I think that owner's affidavit shows that actual notice arose, remember, under the first test, it's undisputed this work was not done on the property. And so you don't even need to reach those other tests if you properly apply the statutory mandate as written, which indicates that for individuals who are leaning for work that's done off the property, this is subsection 3, that this court doesn't have the authority to delete or ignore if the written notice is not submitted, the lien claimant cannot have a lien, period.
Mr. Ulrich, I kind of summarize this. I mean, the way I see it, and correct me if I'm wrong, and we'll ask Mr. Hoy to do also. The record reflected that your client knew there was architectural work being done, but didn't know the identity of the architect, correct?
That's correct. He understood that they were going to try to get entitlements that would require some sort of architectural work to be done. He understood that they had an in-house architect that he thought was doing that, but he never knew who was doing it.
And so I guess the question is how we interpret Fondren and Hardy based on this set of circumstances where you know the work's being done, but you don't know who did it. That kind of Hardy. And
that's what Hardy Company says, is if you know work's being done, but you don't know the identity of who's doing it, that's not enough. And if you look at the court's finding in this case, he basically says exactly that. He says, the Ilyeskis may not have known at all times Stephen's name. But there's no doubt in the court's mind they knew that architectural instruments of service were being created on behalf of the purchaser.
I guess anticipating what your opposing counsel will say is that if you know the work's being done, the architectural work's being done, and you're aware of it, is it really that critical to know the name of the person, or is it the fact of whether the work's being done or not done? What's your position on that?
Well, what this court's position on that question was in Hardy Companies was that, yes, it's critical to know the name of the lien claimant, because if you're not going to acquire that, then this exception that you've created to NRS 108.245 is going to expand and obliterate the rule. And that would certainly be the case here, where it's not even work being performed upon the property.
Now, in this case, there was no preliminary notice ever sent. It's not like this case where it's sent late and maybe you have to prorate the amounts or something like that. It can be lien. So this one is a clear all or nothing situation.
Well, the problem is that the court makes this statement, Stephan may not have known, or Ilyeskis may not have known at all times Stephan's name, and he sort of leaves it at that. He doesn't say when, if ever, they learned his name. I would argue.
On that point, counsel, could you comment on 108.2266, which requires a 15-day notice?
That's a second notice provision.
Correct.
That was also not complied with in this case.
Right.
And we've briefed that. What that requires is notice 15 days prior to actually recording the lien. If the work of improvement involves residential improvements, and this clearly did, it was a multi-use tower that was being planned that would include residential condominiums.
My question, though, is does that statute, we haven't really addressed that statute in the context of Fondren or Hardy or these others, does that trump even a circumstance in which the test in Hardy or Fondren has been satisfied?
Well, I think the Hardy or Fondren test,
15-day notice, nevertheless, right, preclude the lien.
I think it does. I mean, that's what the statute says. This court hasn't really ever addressed that 15-day notice statute. But certainly, that's one more thing that the lien claimant did not do to therefore demonstrate that the lien claimant did not substantially comply with the
lien statute. Was this issue vetted in front of the district court? I didn't see that.
Yes. The very first application for expungement of the lien. Remember, there's two cases here. There's an application to expunge the lien, then there's a lien foreclosure action. They get consolidated. And in the initial application, it indicates that's one of the two issues that they're raising. There was oral arguments and hearing on that. And what the lien claimant indicated was, well, we did eventually send that 15-day notice before we recorded an amended lien. And so the question, I guess, before this court is, can you fix something that requires prior notice after the fact? And it seems to me that the jurisprudence of this court on this question has typically been, we're going to look at whether the lien claimant substantially complied with the lien statute. Whether you would say that one error with respect to the 15-day notice is enough, I don't think you have to answer, because there are other errors here, such as the 31-day notice error.
But is it the case that the record does not show the 15-day notice was sent? It was not sent.
Yeah, it was not sent before the first lien was recorded. It was sent before the amended lien was recorded. That's what the record shows.
All right. You've got about a minute and a half left.
Okay. Well, let me just very quickly say this. Obviously, I don't have time for rebuttal, but my second big argument here is that this is not really Mr. Stephan's lien. And, you know, if you look at the appellant's appendix starting at about page 1012, you'll see that the owner of Fisher Friedman Associates, Mr. Stephan's employer, gets on the stand and he's shown various examples of the instruments of service that have been leaned for in this case. And he's asked, whose work product is that? And he says, Fisher Friedman's work product. And he says that over and over again. That's not on tricky cross-examination testimony where he'd make the Freudian slip or something. That's how their lien claim is really presented. And I think if you look at the BTJ design or decision, and if you look at even more so the Snyder decision, it's clear that what this court expects is for a lien claimant to come into court and say, I'm here leaning for my work product. You know, I built that, and I'm leaning for it. And my employees built it. My subcontractors built it. Here's how I verify my invoices. You know, and that's just not the way this case was presented. You know, probably in the short time I have, the best thing that could happen to my clients today on this issue is if I could convince any member of this panel who's inclined to uphold this lien to just first grab their direct case-in-chief testimony of Mr. Friedman or Mr. Steppen. Take a page at random and read for 10, 15, 20 pages and see if it looks like, and see if you can remember that the lien claimant in this case is Mark Steppen. And if you can do that, you've got greater powers of concentration than I do, because the lien claim continuously seems to be a lien claim that's being proved up for somebody other than the lien claimant, and as happened in the Snyder case, without even reaching the licensing issues, this court said, that's just not how it works. You can't lien for somebody else's stuff.
Chief, if I may,
sure, go ahead.
Just as a follow-up, what testimony was there that supported any work that Steppen did on the project?
Well, Steppen testified that he treated this project the same way that he treated his work on any other Fisher Friedman project, just doing the same things that he would do on any other project, even though this was the first time that he had signed the contract for Fisher Friedman's work. And so what it comes down to is if you look at the invoices and you sort of add up the time, it looks to us like Mr. Steppen spent about 5% of the architectural time that was, or 5% of the employee time of Fisher Friedman Associates was Mr. Steppen time. That was the concession made by his counsel in post-trial briefing. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Albert. Mr. Boyd.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, associate members. May it please the court, my name is Michael Foy. I represent the respondent, Mark Steppen, in this case. This is a tough record for this court to review. It's an even tougher case for this court to reverse what happened in the district court. And I say that for a number of different reasons. We had three different district judges below. All three of those judges made dispositive rulings in this case. For Dr. and Mrs. Iliescu, there were at least five sets of lawyers in the case. Mark Steppen had two sets of lawyers. He began with Gail Kern early on in the case, and then I took over the case somewhere in the middle, finished up discovery, and took it to trial. And so when you go back and review the record below, you will see that there's no consistency there in terms of what issues are being preserved. And this goes to the heart of appellate review in this case. Appellate review is a one-way street in this sense. This court can affirm based on any basis in the record. But this court does not reverse unless there's an issue that is preserved on appeal below. So let me tackle Justice Hardesty's question about the 15-day notice and how and when that issue was preserved for appeal or not preserved for appeal. The issue was first discussed orally. It was in a May 3rd, 2007 hearing with Judge Adams. This is before the mechanics lien foreclosure action was even filed. This was Dr. and Mrs. Iliescu's application to expunge the lien. And during that hearing, Jerry Snyder from Hale Lane was representing Dr. Iliescu. Gail Kern was representing Mark Steppen. And there was a discussion, and I can cite to the actual discussion before the court. Ms. Kern informed the court that the here it is. It's the transcript, page 15, Appellant's Appendix, page 123. Ms. Crone says to Judge Adams, the 15-day notice, in my opinion, is not required under this circumstance. I do not believe this is a residential property that is subject of that prelim notice, et cetera, et cetera. Then she says to Judge Adams, so that portion of it goes away, and in my discussions with Mr. Snyder, we did agree that the real meat and the real issue, because that can be corrected, that that defect can be taken care of. And then she goes on to talk about the fonder issue. Mr. Snyder does not get up and say, wait a minute, no, we're not waiving our argument on 108.226 sub 6, the 15-day notice. It is, that's the end of the discussion of the 15-day notice. So there is a period of discovery. Judge Adams then enters summary judgment on the Fondren issue and does not address the 15-day notice issue. The 15-day notice issue was not raised in those briefs. Years later, two judges later, we are in trial. The 15-day issue is not raised again in the trial statement. It's not raised in closing argument. It's not raised again until post-trial and post-judgment when Dr. and Mrs. Oleescu file their NRCP 60B motion. A post-judgment motion is not a place to raise or preserve for appeal a substantive issue that has been long forgotten in the case. Much of the focus of the oral presentation so far has been the Fondren notice issue and the Hardy notice issue. And the representation has been made both in oral arguments and in the briefing that there was never a finding by a court, by the district court, that Dr. and Mrs. Oleescu had notice of the identity of Stepan. The representation was that the record below only supports the finding that Oleescu knew that there was work being done, but didn't ever know the identity of Mark Stepan. So if we go back to 2009, the June 22nd order, and this is appellant's appendix, page 509, Judge Adams' summary judgment order says the applicants, that's the Oleescus, specifically Oleescu, viewed the architectural drawings as well as attended meetings where the design team presented the drawings. The court finds, even though Oleescu alleges he did not know the identity of the architects who were working on the project, he had actual knowledge that the respondent, Mark Stepan, and his firm were performing architectural services on the project.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel's statement that Mark Stepan's involvement was approximately 5%?
I believe it's in the ballpark. Part of the problem here is we had a stopgap agreement at the beginning of the design contract. That later, from the start, the parties anticipated that there would be a fixed price contract, the standard AIA, I think it was a B-141 1907 version, but they anticipated at the beginning that there would be a fixed fee to do the work. And by fixed, I mean a percentage of the construction cost or the anticipated construction cost. When the architect first sent that form over to the developer engaged Hale Lane to review that contract, and that's early November of 2005. It then became evident that the attorney process, or the attorney review would take some time, and so the architect proposed, well, we'll get started on an hourly basis. So there were time cards at the beginning, but those time cards didn't really record all of the time. Those time cards were not part of the trial record. Those time cards never came into the district court record until the Rule 60B motion, when the argument was made Stepan didn't have enough to do with the case. So we can't pin it down based on the trial testimony how much work Stepan did. But his testimony was that he effectively was the project manager. He supervised the actual design work going on. He supervised administrative matters such as contracting and invoicing and those types of things. So the 5% number doesn't ring a bell with me, but I'm not saying that's not correct.
Thank you.
So we have Judge Adams entering a partial summary judgment that Iliescu's knew the identity of Stepan. Then after trial, we have findings and conclusions by Judge Sattler. And Judge Sattler said, Iliescu's may not have known at all times the identity of Stepan. But contrary to what you've possibly read and heard, there was no finding by Judge Sattler that the Iliescu's never knew the identity of Stepan. And so that gets us to this new argument about when Iliescu knew the identity of Stepan. And this, again, gets us back to how do you preserve issues for appellate review. This issue was also discussed early on in the case. It wasn't in the briefs. It was in a discussion, a colloquy between Jerry Snyder and Judge Adams back on May 3rd, 2007. And Mr. Snyder argued to Judge Adams that Fonda notice should only be effective with regard to work performed 31 days before notice under Fonda. And Judge Adams says, well, that's an interesting theory and it makes sense. Is there any law on that? And Mr. Snyder said, no, there is no law on that. That issue, again, disappears from the record for a period of years. It's not argued at trial. It's not argued again until post-judgment briefing.
Weren't there affirmative defenses raised by the Iliescu's in their answer to the complaint regarding the lien issues? Or?
I would invite the court to review that answer because the answer is no. There are no affirmative defenses raised in the answer that Stepan failed to perfect his lien under NRS Chapter 108. There's just a series of the kind of the generic affirmative defenses that you would find in any case.
Could you comment? Excuse me.
I was just going to have one more question.
Certainly.
Mr. Hoy, just for my own edification. On this 15-day notice issue, the 15 days is required before you file your claim of lien, as I understand that statute. Was all the work completed by your client by that date, that the 15-day notice would have been due if it had been filed, or was there still extra, was there still ongoing work at that stage of the case?
I don't believe, Your Honor, at that point. This would have been the latter part of 2006, probably October or November of 2006, and I believe there was work still progressing, but the work, now let me back up. The trial court found that the schematic design phase of the architectural work had been completed, and it had been completed in a way that the City of Reno issued a tentative map and special use permit based upon that, but the architectural design continued after that. So we don't have a trial record that specifically said when the work ended. There is some general testimony but that the work continued, or the design continued to evolve up until the time the lien was recorded.
Okay, thank you.
Aside from actual notice to Dr. and Mrs. Iliescu that has been found by district court, the record also supports findings that were not made, which are that Sam Coniglia was effectively the owner's agent. This is important because Sam Coniglia was the fellow who signed the design contract with Stepan. Sam Coniglia was the person identified in the owner's affidavit to the City of Reno saying that this person has our consent to seek entitlements, development entitlements, for our property. But even going back before that, as Judge Elliott found, the Iliescus, at the moment they signed the land purchase agreement, knew that there was going to be work done on this project by engineers and by architects. And we know that because the contract itself says that the Iliescus will cooperate in the procurement of these development entitlements, and indeed that the Iliescus will benefit from these entitlements. And this land purchase agreement vests a certain amount of equitable right in the buyers. In fact, the record even contains a notice of claim of entitlement when the developer goes bankrupt. In the bankruptcy court, they notice that they had an equitable right to this property. But the point for NRS Chapter 108 is this. There's a statutory definition of the owner's agent contained in, I think it's 108.22160 or thereabouts. And it says, an owner of the agent, for purposes of the lien statute, is any party who has power in the property or power to control the property. And that's the power that the Iliescus invested in Sam Coniglia and his company to control aspects of this property. So for purposes of deciding whether there's imputed knowledge through agency law, we also have this definition in Chapter 108 that plainly says that Coniglia and his company are agents of the owner. And then you get to the agency of a lawyer. And counsel said this morning that Fondren requires some evidence that the lawyers actually communicated with the client.
Wouldn't finish it off.
That the lawyer actually communicates with the client, and that's just not what Fondren says. Fondren says, in this case, the owner had a lawyer who was observing construction on the site. But that case also says that the lawyer's knowledge is imputed to the client. Fondren does not say that there was evidence that the lawyer actually communicated with his client in that case.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your time is up, so sorry. But thank you to both counsel here for their excellent arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stay submitted. We're recessed.